At this time, K2 KEY, Mel, and Dick, K2 RIW, that's who you're listening to. Start a thing called the TechNet. And the TechNet, as you guys have heard a thousand times before, in theory, is it's a gathering of the clan in which we help each other get more enjoyment and more understanding out of this fairly complicated hobby called ham radio. We usually discuss things like antennas and transmission lines and transmitters and receivers and propagation and the 26 different kinds of ham radio. Of interest to ham radio operators. If you have a question or a comment for the net, please sign in and give me your call letters, your name, and follow that with the word yes, which means that you do have a question or a comment. Do we have any check-ins at this time? Please give me your call letters, name, and that yes. K2RIW listening.
Why, Joe. No questions at this time. M2NQK, yes, I have a question. Jim.
We got you, Jim. All right, we got Joe and Jim so far. Anyone else?
Evening, all. This is K2KEY.
Yeah, what is your name, sir? That was a joke. Okay. Anyone else to check in? Please give me your call letters and name right now.
KB1NNH, Jerry, just listen.
Is that Mike November, Jerry?
Kilo Bravo 1, November Hotel.
Okay, NNH. Alrighty. And I think that was with a no for Jerry so far. But if you got a lot of change of mind, Jerry, and make it into a yes after you find out all the juicy subjects we sometimes talk about. So far we've got Mel, Joe, Jim, and Jerry. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name and that yes right now.
N2RSO, Frank, no.
Frank with a no. Anyone else? Sounds like November, Juliet, Charlie. Bill with a no. Okay. Joe, I'm pretty sure you said no, but if not, we're going to give you another opportunity. W-A-2-R-Y-Y. You do or don't have anything that you'd like to discuss, Joe. K-2-R-I-W.
I have no real questions at this time.
Nice delay and feedback. Okay, Joe. Jim, looks like so far you are the only yes person. The TechNet usually runs for 4 hours, or darn close to it. And if no one else checks in, just think, you can get 4 hours of service, Jim. Just think of the opportunity. Take your own free time, give us lots of questions. N2, November Kilo, November Quebec Kilo, I think it is. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Okay, Dick, thank you very much. Now, it looks like I'm the only guy that doesn't know anything, I suppose. But I have basically a question about... Normally, I operate on 146.52. I meet a group of guys there. And what happens, usually Monday and Tuesday, I guess when you guys have your net going on here, and my local repeater... on 146.685 in Babylon. When both repeaters are up at the same time, what happens is an image or a carrier is with both frequencies. I can hear both frequencies transmissions as they speak. And the carrier on my end, 146.52 is approximately, depending upon where my antenna is pointed, approximately a 20 over, which significantly wipes out everybody that I'm talking to. So basically, I was going to ask you, is there anything I can do to eliminate that image or whatever you want to call it from wiping out 5-2 on me?
W-H-Y-Y.
Go ahead, Joe. I got lots of opinions, but Joe's going to tell us some first. Go ahead, Joe.
It's direct overload from 146.85 because I just took it out of my calculator. 146.85 times 2 minus 146.85 is a direct hit of 146.52.
That's right. That's exactly right. That's how I figured it also.
2RSO with a comment.
All righty. Got lots of opinions on this. Frank, go right ahead.
Okay. It's my understanding that 146.52 is a national calling frequency. And to be courteous, a ham is supposed to call, make a contact, and switch to another frequency. My suggestion to avoid all these interference problems is have your net on 146.535 or .55 and leave .52 as a calling frequency. Back to net and to RSO.
Okay, Frank has explained a fallback position, a way of getting around the problem without fixing it. Reminds me a little bit, though, Frank, of what some people do where they've got joint pain. They'll take a painkiller as opposed to finding out what's causing the joint pain. So the fact that you stop the body from sensing that there's pain at the joint doesn't stop the fact that maybe damage is taking place. Well, in this particular case, there's no damage taking place, but I'm reasonably sure that Jim is looking for a solution. What we're describing here has been called overload, simple front-end overload, strong signal characteristic. If you really want to read up on it mathematically and or scientifically, so to speak, it's called third-order intermodulation distortion. You notice that what Joe did was to take one of the frequencies, multiply it by two, and modulation. That's exactly what every amplifier in every receiver is doing all the time. In other words, every one of our amplifiers, whether it be made out of tubes, whether it be bipolar transistors, FET transistors, or whatever, every single amplifier, you put in a small signal at the grid or gate or base, and out of the plate or collector, you collect a larger signal, usually if you're using it in such a way that you're getting gain. The good news is the signal coming out is larger than the signal that comes in. And you think that what's going on is that the signal you put in got multiplied in magnitude. It's a good guess. It's not exactly what goes on. In reality, what every one of these amplifying devices is doing, and I'll go back to the tube case because the tubes in some people's minds are a little bit easier to understand. You got some electrons flowing from the cathode to the plate. The plate has usually got, let me pick a number, 350 volts on it. The cathode is essentially grounded. And in between, you got this control grid. So there's a zillion electrons boiling off from that cathode, moving at close to the speed of light toward the plate. And in between is this grid, which as you put positive and negative voltages on that grid, it either repels some of those electrons.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
It repels some of those electrons, and they don't get a chance to boil off. That's when the grid has got a negative voltage. The grid has got a positive voltage on it, in my simple example. It sucks more electrons off of the control, off of the cathode, and so therefore they move toward the plate with a greater number of them. So in other words, the voltage you're putting on the control grid is modulating the number of electrons, making the number of electrons go up and down. So you'll notice that your particular signal that you put on the control grid, not one single electron per se left that control grid. Of the electrons that you supplied for that signal to the control grid, none of them left the control grid. So what the amplifier has done is it has replicated your signal with another completely independent stream of electrons. And the new stream of electrons has a greater number going up and down in number as the voltage is positive and negative on the control grid. So you're replicating the signal, and what comes out, if the tube's a good one, is a stronger signal
but it's not the same signal. It's a duplication, a replication. Well, it's a doppelganger. Duplication is never perfect. When you start digging into the mathematics of what happens, every amplifier you and I can touch has a degree of nonlinearity. If I took the signal coming out, readjusted its vertical deflection, and I graphed it, and on top of that graph, and I graphed it with blue pencil, and on top of that with red pencil, I put the signal that I'm putting into the control grid. The two signals will look very close, but not exactly the same. The blue signal coming out of the plate might have a little bit more flat topping at the peaks of the sine wave. It might cross through zero a little bit early or a little bit late. There's slight changes. The duplicate is not perfect. As you really study how to use a tube amplifier or a transistor amplifier or a field effect transistor or an operational amplifier, any of these amplifying devices, electronic amplifiers we can get our hands on, as you study how to use them, as you buy the ones with higher quality, as you use them under better and better conditions, the degree of nonlinearity gets smaller. They get more and more higher in fidelity.
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
But even the perfect ones, the most expensive ones you can buy, the Cadillacs and the Rolls Royces of amplifiers, still have a degree of difference between the replicated signal and the signal you supply. Fact number one. Accept the fact that everything is imperfect when you get down to the nitty-gritty. Fact number two, the degree of imperfection goes up cube law with amplitude. If I put twice as much signal on the control grid, I'd like to get twice as much signal out of the plate of my tube circuit. And for the most part, I will. But when I study the degree of nonlinearity, the degree of nonlinearity is two or three times greater with a signal that's twice as big. So, what makes intermodulation distortion? Number one, everything has got nonlinearity. Two, how strong is the signal? Three, are two independent signals present? In the case of the intermodulation distortion, you just saw Joe calculate. He knew that there was a 0.685 and there's a 0.85 signal simultaneously present on your amplifying device, probably the first amplifier or the second amplifier of your rig that's doing the listening on 146.52. By way of using an antenna that's got directivity, where you aim the antenna at one repeater or the other, or in the case of 5.2, you aim it at the guy who's transmitting the 5.2 signal, and hopefully it rejects the other repeaters on 0.685 and 0.85. That's one approach. That's called spatial selectivity. So by using the right kind of an antenna pattern, you can enhance the signal you're listening for, the 5.2, and de-enhance the other signals. In your particular case, you probably only have to eliminate one of the offending signals, of the two signals, in order for the effect to go away. That's one approach. You can put in a notch filter for one of those signals, right in front of the receiver. Notch out to 0.85 just during the time you're listening to 5.2. That would eliminate it. So, changing the antenna pattern, changing the filter characteristics so that both signals are not there, or changing the amplitude. I had, when I was doing a lot of contest work on the 432 megacycle band, quite often during the heat of battle of a contest, when there's a whole lot of strong signal, there's a whole lot of strong signals in direct line of sight of me, coming from Connecticut, and I'm trying to listen to a weak signal up in Maine, and I'm essentially listening in the same direction. The strong signals in Connecticut were creating intermods that were bombing the daylights out of the weak signal from the guy in Maine I wanted to talk to. The signal in Maine is weak. I made the signal in Maine stronger by comparison by putting in a 10 decibel attenuator in front of the receiver. Of course that sounds crazy. By lowering the amplitude of the two signals coming from Connecticut by 10 dB by plugging in the attenuator, the third order intermod they were creating went down by 30 dB. It's a 3-to-1 ratio. The intermod they were making, which in your case would be 0.52, will go down 30 dB when you plug in 10 dB of attenuation. Quite possibly your receiver has on the front panel a little button you can push that's called ATT, attenuator. and you press that attenuator, I'll bet you'll discover that the guy you're listening to on 5-2 gets weaker, but he might still be above threshold, but the interference you were getting from the two strong repeaters will most likely disappear, or at least it's going to go down by 30 dB. So during the contest, quite often, I would plug in the attenuation in order to work the weak guy. As long as he was strong enough to be above, more than 10 dB above my noise, if he was only 4 dB above my noise and I plug in 10 dB of attenuation, obviously he's now below the noise, I'm not going to hear him. But if he was, let's say, 15 dB above my noise, but being covered up by an intermod from the two Connecticut guys, that's 30 dB above my noise, and therefore I couldn't hear Maine, by plugging in the attenuation, 10 dB of attenuation, it solved the problem. So, I've given you three solutions so far. There's a fourth solution. Solution number one was antenna pattern. Solution number two was notching out one of the signals with a filter. Solution number three was attenuation. Solution number four is to find out which stage of your receiver is the first one to have the most amount of nonlinearity when strong signals come in. Readjust the amplitude of the signals going into that stage, or readjust the bias point on that stage. I have studied high dynamic range receivers. There's usually a weak link in the chain somewhere. Maybe it's the first mixer. And if you change the local oscillator power or...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Change the local oscillator power or change the bias point so that it has a higher intercept point. Linearity of a stage or where it starts making intermods, it's called third order intercept point. It's a way of calculating how strong the intermod will be when you know the strength of the two ascending signals. It's a method of calculating it. So you can change the characteristic of the stage of the receiver, which happens to be the weakest link in the chain, the guy that's making the interference. Most likely interference is not really coming down your antenna. 99% of the time it's created in your own electronics, in your own shack, because of simple RF overload, limited dynamic range, and the presence of strong signals simultaneously in that receiver. So as you can see, there's essentially four solutions there, Jim. You're into a interesting subject, which very few amateurs have a great deal of understanding for. When you look at the rating sheets that QST Magazine has for every new piece of equipment, you'll see that one of the things that they plot for you for every new piece of equipment coming out in the product report is what is the third order intercept point of the receiver. And they give you a sliding scale as to how good that particular one is. So even before you spend your money to buy that particular receiver, QST's laboratory will tell you what they measured, which would, in theory, allow you to calculate how strong or how close can I be to repeaters and still receive signals without this distortion product giving me problems. I know that's a bit more than you wanted there, Jim, and Mel and I sometimes say, you don't have to read it all, but it's nice to know it's all there. N2K, K2LIW.
K2K, why would it comment?
Stand by there, Jim. Go ahead, Mel.
Hey. Well, we could go back to the old days. In fact, I have carried that over. The old timers had a very good saying, ride the RF game. What did they mean by that? Well, on HF, especially the radios of those days, the receivers, and to improve the selectivity, what you did, you left the AF gain, that's at a comfortable level, but you turned your RF gain. Now, those receivers of those days, of course, had an RF gain knob that was triggered the AF gain knob, right, usually side by side. And what you do is bring the RF gain up just so you can make out comfortably copy the signal that you desired. And in this way, especially, you know, on conditions on the HF band, I find that this is, besides filters, besides the notch filters and everything else that's included in the radios and what you can get today with DSP, I still find that old situation of riding the RF gain dip as really one of the best ways to dig out the weak signal. Over.
Fantastic. I'm looking at now my Kenwood TS711A, which is what you guys are listening to. It's a 2-meter all-mode rig. And it has on the lower right-hand corner, the outer knob, inner knob is called AF gain, the outer knob is RF gain. When the receiver, transceiver, is in the sideband mode, then that RF gain knob is active, and I can lower the gain of the first stage of RF amplification in this receiver in order to protect it from overload if I happen to be operating at a contest site where, you know, one-tenth away, 10 feet away from me is another strong signal that's giving me grief. So by lowering the RF gain knob, which usually affects the gain of the very first stage of the receiver, it's the electronic equivalent of putting an attenuator in front of the receiver. And as you lower the signal amplitude by lowering the gain, whatever stage downrange in the receiver becomes nonlinear and makes this distortion product is being protected, and you get the best possible dynamic range for that particular condition. That's what Mel was talking about in riding the RF gain control. So you can do it electronically, continuously. You can do it with some kind of a potentiometer-like network between the antenna and the receiver. You can do it with step attenuators. You can do it with fixed attenuators. You can do it with filters. You can do it with antenna performance. And you can do it by modifying the design of the receiver itself. To make a receiver that has the highest possible dynamic range, to make a receiver that has the lowest possible signal reception capability, very sensitive, and to make a receiver that takes very little power, like a portable handy talkie, to ask for all of those things simultaneously is a conflict of interest. There's a compromise between the two. High dynamic range receivers, by definition, must draw more current. So therefore, when it comes to a handy talkie that you connect to a real good antenna on top of the tower, because it doesn't have enough volume inside for a good front end filter, because the main design criteria the manufacturer had, let me drop. Andy recognized, I'll go to you in a second. The main thing the receiver manufacturer had in his mind was to design the handy talkie so it would run the longest period of time on its battery. Therefore, he designs it for low current drain. Therefore, by definition, each one of the stages of the handy talkie is not a high dynamic range stage. It cannot tolerate strong signals without developing overload and distortion. So you got a conflict of interest. A good benchtop radio has a good front-end filter, and it draws considerably more current. And when you want to run it from a battery, you'll get a little bit unhappy, but it can tolerate stronger signals. But you buy the tape recording like I did of astronaut Owen Garriott on the space shuttle in 1986 when people were talking to him. He had his Motorola handy-talkie connected to an antenna that was taped to the observation window of the space shuttle as he flew over the United States. And my goodness, was that receiver overloaded like crazy. It wasn't designed for that application, so to speak. They tested it in the laboratory. They thought they had done everything. They didn't give it 5,000 signals simultaneously that he was in view of. He was 150 nautical miles above the center of the United States. He was looking at a couple of thousand mile diameter of humanity all at once, and at least 1,000 hams were all shouting at him at the same time. My goodness, did he have overload of that poor handy talkie. And the laboratory, before they sent him into space, did they put 1,000 simultaneous signals into that handy talkie? You know the answer to that. Therefore, they got one hell of a surprise. So they do CDL. I bet you run into some overload characteristics of some of the equipment you work with, Andy. K2RIW and TechNet. You got it, Andy.
Yeah, Dick, that's an understatement. Yeah, but, you know, there's one thing that puzzles me. Maybe you could clarify this. By the way, WHCDL Mobile. I'm going to be leaving in a minute. I'm in and out quick. But if this guy is, I don't know where he's located, receiving this intermod signal from this repeater, this repeater comes into my house on a diamond antenna on my tower, about minus 80, 85 dBm or so. I can't see how the intermod is generated in his radio, if that's the case. Where is the IM product being generated? The repeater is not strong enough. Maybe, you got some info on that.
Oh boy, have I got news for you. Good old Jim in NQNQK lives in West Babylon. Also in West Babylon is the 146.835 repeater, or the 685, 146.685 repeater, right in his backyard. All he needs is one of the signals to be strong enough to create overload. The other signal just happens to be at the right frequency so that the intermod falls on 5-2 where he listens to. So at his QTH, I'm predicting the 8-5 signal is nice and weak, but he's right in the backyard of the 685 repeater in West Babylon where he lives. Wonder if that makes more sense, Andy. To A2CDL, K2LIW.
Okay, I didn't know that he's out near that the 685 repeater. Okay. Alright, that's a possibility. I don't know what radio that he's using. I'm not 100% sure, but it's possible. If there's a way that he can measure the strength of the repeater coming into his radio in dBm, that would be a good indication. All right, I'll give it back to you. I'll just keep listening.
Well, wait a minute here now, Andy. Say, for instance, I'm building a fireplace in your backyard, a barbecue fireplace, and I'm making a nice red brick. And you say to me, hey, Dick, how do I know that those are mil-spec bricks? Have you measured the weight of that one? Does gravity affect it the same way? When I drop it, is it going to fall? I mean, in theory, you could ask me those silly questions. A rational person will say, hey, it's a brick. You put some cement on it, and you pile it the right way, and it's going to make a fireplace. I don't have to get into those details. I can take it on faith. A brick is a brick is a brick. I don't have to test this particular brick. So let me repeat. If I understand correctly, West Babylon is where the 685 repeater is. Assuming the 685 repeater is designed to have a coverage of, let's say, 30 miles radius, and he's a fraction of a mile from it, with an outdoor antenna or even an indoor antenna. But let's assume it's an outdoor antenna. If he is a fraction of a mile from a repeater, and you and I know what the inverse square law is, and the repeater is designed to cover 30 miles, so let's assume he's a third of a mile, he's 1/90th of the range away from the repeater. Do I have to measure the signal at his QTH to know it's going to be a whopper and it's going to be strong? Let's assume it's a 50-watt output repeater with a 10 dB gain antenna a third of a mile from him with direct line of sight. Do I have to measure that signal to know it's going to be strong? The major CDO, KQLIW.
Okay, no, I'm not arguing that point. I understand the signal will be strong, and that's why I said it's a possibility. I'm not saying it's definite because I don't know which radio that he's using. I don't know the details, but yes, that the repeater would be very strong, and that could happen. I'll be back. I just got to pull into the store. And I'll continue listening for other comments, Dick. By the way, I came on for a specific reason. How does the repeater sound to you, Dick? Is it the normal level that you see it at?
To me, it's potent today. It's giving me lots of signal. And by the way, I know where you're going, Andy. Almost everybody who does a two-tone test puts in two equal amplitude signals. And although you didn't say it, what you were thinking is that, okay, there's a 685 signal and there's a 0.85 signal. Are both of them strong enough to make an intermod? Well, it turns out only one signal has to be strong enough to drive the radio somewhere into nonlinearity, and then even though the other signal is weak, it'll make an intermod of it. It'll make a stronger intermod if the other signal is also strong. You only need one strong signal to create the nonlinearity. You make a nonlinearity in a stage at any one frequency. By definition, it is shoved into nonlinearity at all frequencies going through that amplifier at that period of time that the strong signal is present. So only one strong signal, I'm guessing it's the 685, in his town with him. I've made a couple of guesses here, Jim, that the 685 repeater is essentially in your town, not very far from you. Correct me if I'm wrong. N2NQK, a guy who asked us a very interesting question. K2 KQRIW, you got it, Jim. My name is Dick.
Okay, Dick, thanks. N2NQK here. Boy, did I open up something here. The repeater is no more than half a mile from me. I can go on the roof and see the antenna. I'm using an ICOM IC910, which is a very nice radio. I love it. It's a great radio. It does a very good job for me. And the 850 machine pegs me here at the 60 over. So I have a pretty good intense signal from both repeaters, obviously. It's not that the 850 machine is doing an S9 or a 20 over. It's pegging me at 60 over. So I know there was another station and I said I shouldn't be on 5-2, but I sit there all day, or not all day, when I get home from work, and I hear absolutely nothing. Nothing, nothing, nothing. And I have a group of guys that come in there and say hello, and we talk and we chat. And if somebody wants to come in there and use the frequency, they're welcome to. But I'm not going to just abandon a frequency just because it's a calling frequency. If anybody wants to get in there, they're certainly welcome to do so. And so that's it. That's my soapbox for that. And I don't know. It's not a life altering thing. It just 2 days out of the week, I think it is Monday and Tuesday when the nets are on. It sort of messes me up, and I can't talk to the guys I want to talk to. So that's the only reason why I brought it up. I'm not going to lose any sleep over it, but I would like any options, and you gave me a bunch of options. A notch filter might be a good try for it. And then, of course, as the other gentleman said there, get the hell off the frequency. So if we can do it that way also. But I would just like to, just a simple question, just to find out what in the world is going on and why such a good radio should act like that. And you've given me a whole bunch of clues as to why it does that, N2NQK.
Who we owe, Dick. Rich recognized. Don't blame the radio. When you read the product reports in QSC magazine for every one of the radios you and I can buy, Jim, they all have a level of overload. Almost all of the radios you can buy connected to your good antenna in your town, a half mile away from a potent repeater, is going to experience something like what you described. If I went through the four or five major brands of radios and plugged them into your particular antenna, some of them would have the intermod a couple of dB stronger than the others, but they're all going to be getting the effect. And so it's the nature of the beast of electronic amplification. Every amplifier has some level of overload, and you're asking for extremely high linearity in this particular environment. Now, on a quick break, Jim, does your IC910 have a button on the front panel or a knob or whatever called attenuator? If it's only an FM rig, most likely it does not. But if it's a all-mode rig, most likely it does. If there's a push-button attenuator on the front panel and you try using it, you might be pleasantly surprised. Back to you, Jim, for a quick break on that one.
Okay, Dick. Yes, it's an all-mode radio, 2-meter 440, and it does have an attenuator button. And it does, of course, cut down some of the interference. Instead of a 20 over, it may go down to a 5 over. But unfortunately, I use a beam. I talk to people that are 20, 30 miles away constantly. I talk to people in Staten Island, Manhattan, New Jersey, and that's basically are the people who I talk to. So I do use a beam. It's an 11-element beam on an 18-foot boom. And I suppose I could spin it around and get the signal dropped there. But the attenuator doesn't do the whole trick. It does some of it, but it doesn't do it all. Back to you, Dick, M2NQK.
Yeah, stand by a minute, Rich. I got another guess here. Murphy's Law dictates that you can rotate your beam in such a direction where you don't get the problem. In other words, you know out, so to speak, the 685 machine, and now the problem almost goes away. Unfortunately, when your beam is aimed in that direction, it's not aimed at the guy you want to talk to on 5-2. Murphy's Law dictates that the guys you want to talk to are going to be directly in one of the directions when you get a strong signal from the 685 repeater. So, of all the choices you've got, making a notch at 685 or making a notch at 85, either one would do it. And there's a couple of simple circuits you could do. You could go out and buy a good cavity filter or build a good cavity filter on 2 meters. The guys have sometimes done it with a galvanized garbage can, believe it or not, made a high-Q cavity filter and tune it to 146.52 and eliminate all other signals other than the one you want to listen to and get full sensitivity. That would be kind of fun as an experiment. Or a simple notch filter. There's lots of ways of doing that with a T-connector and a piece of coax cable and a variable capacitor on the end of the cable. There's some fairly simple designs on making a notch filter and notch out 685 or 0.85. You've already used the antenna. You've already used the attenuator. Redesigning your IC910, not likely you want to go that far. Other than that, eliminating the problem in your environment is a little bit difficult, as you can tell. Now, those guys in Whitestone, they know how to live with strong signals. That's what Richard's got to say. And now that he knows how to use operational amplifiers, he can show us how to make an op-amp notch circuit. And I'm only half kidding when I say that. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick, N2EO. By the way, put me down with a question. A little hard to talk, have a very bad cold. But I was going to suggest maybe you could build himself like a variable attenuator to put in the line with the radio that he can vary and receive the amount of attenuation and switch it out using either a relay or pin diode on transmit. What do you think of that, Dick? Because the attenuator button on a lot of these radios, they call it an attenuator, but they don't actually put it ahead of the RF stage. They put it somewhere else, or sometimes it's not an attenuator at all. What they do is they drop out a second RF stage. Now that's what they call it anyway. Yeah, Dick.
That's not a bad thing, though. Dropping out a second RF stage. Let's assume now that the very first stage, that's the weakest link in the chain, that creates the nonlinearity, that creates the intermod that Jim is experiencing. Let's assume that that first stage is the mixer. And there's two RF amplifiers in front of the mixer, in my example. And if I bypass one of those RF amplifiers, I have lowered the total amount of gain between the antenna and the mixer, and the number of decibels that I lower the gain, times two or times three, would be the amount of attenuation of the intermod. So that could definitely help, even though it's in the wrong place by your standards. You and I think that the best place to put it is right at the antenna port, and they usually don't always do that. And there's a bunch of reasons why they don't do that. However, I know what Jim is doing now. He's a 146.52 guy with a beam. He's looking for 2-meter vertically polarized TX. He likes to talk to somebody 150 miles away if he can. And putting any attenuation in front of his receiver, particularly if he is using a so-called rice box, an ICOM IC910, is made in Southeast Asia, and with rare exception, everything made in Southeast Asia is made for strong signal overload characteristics. It was originally designed for, let me drop, use in downtown Tokyo, where there's a ham radio operator on every street corner. So strong signal overload is the main thing they care about. Weak signal reception is not as important. Therefore, every rice box we buy, with rare exception, is gain-starved. There's not as much RF amplification in there in order to get the highest dynamic range. And therefore, if you're living in a rural area and you want to really start operating DX, we all put a preamplifier in front of our all-mode rig. And therefore, get a whole lot more sensitivity out of it. Many of the rice boxes have a 12 or 14 decibel noise figure on 2 meters. You put a advanced receiver research gas-fed preamplifier in front of it, which has got half a dB noise figure. All of a sudden, your 14 dB noise figure of your receiver goes to a half a dB noise figure. You get about 15 decibels of more sensitivity to a sideband signal. You put a preamplifier in front of it, the opposite of putting in a attenuator. And as long as you're just listening to that weak signal, boy, you're going to get a lot more range out of that rig. And hear a lot weaker signal, a lot further away, hold QSOs and be happy. If and only if there aren't strong local signals overloading your receiver. And with the preamp in front, it's going to overload a hell of a lot easier. So the filter approach to pass the frequencies only of the signal you want to listen to and reject all others, or if you're lucky enough, let me drop. If you're lucky enough that there's only one major strong offending signal, which in Jim's case is most likely 146.685, if he notches out that one frequency, 90% of his grief is going to disappear, in my opinion. So he's about to do a bunch of experiments with and without preamps, with and without notch filter, various antenna directions and whatever. He's going to discover a whole lot of science and art of high dynamic range receiver techniques. I'm the guy who wrote a very elaborate computer program once, which tries to study the ideal dynamic range of a particular military receiver that goes on an Air Force airplane. I wrote a very elaborate computer program saying that if we boost the gain of this stage a little bit and lower the gain of that stage a little bit, we'll keep the exact same sensitivity, but we'll get 5 or 10 dB more dynamic range out of this receiver system. I've worked on those kind of problems. They're not easy, but with a little bit of study, and as I said, a modern-day computer program, you could even do it on pencil and paper, but you get a faster solution with a good computer program. You can optimize a receiver for dynamic range. But in this particular case, I think filtering and/or notching is going to be his strong suit here. That's going to give him the most bang for the dollar. Let's see if Andy came back from the... if Andy or anyone else wants to put in their 2 cents worth or further questions on this particular subject, give me a call. Let us right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
This is K2KEY.
Bell recognized. Anyone else? Okay.
KC2DNA, just listening.
KC2, Delta November Alpha is what it sounds like. A listener. Hey, we've got a couple of those with the DNA. nice of the call wires, call letters. Dioxy DNA. You know what it stands for. Nucleic acid. Dioxynucleic acid, something like that. Mel, the guy who has had sore fingers from all of those years of riding that RF gain control on his Collins 51J receiver while listening to those weak signal sideband signals during all those expeditions in the southwestern Pacific. Is that RF gain control of yours sometimes needing a squirt of tuna cleaner because it's been used so much it's starting to get scratchy? K2KEY, K2LIW.
Wore out. This is K2KEY. Well, you know, me and I was interested in weak signal conditions. In fact, apropos to that, I picked up a signal and worked a guy in an island called the Manlina Island the other day that's near Madagascar. It's a small island off Madagascar. He comes on once in a while, and he's running fairly low power. And his signal is usually just fairly audible, so you've got to really use everything at your disposal to try to dig him out. I've been looking for him for a number of years, and I finally bumped into him. The point is that the receiver that I constructed, you remember that, Dodger, with the filters and everything, I have a switch on it, and many switches on it. Sometimes before I get things set up, the contact is a station is gone, I can't make contact. But, all kidding aside, I have on there not only variable control of my number of ways, my preselector and my RF gain, but I also can switch off the RF amplifier, so get the RF amplifier out, switch it out, and you'll be amazed that many times that is an important factor. That, in other words, try to keep it from getting in right at the source of the receiver, and of course, careful design of the mixes and everything else goes along with it, but I find that many times without the RF amplifier, I can do quite well, Dick, over.
In the case of HF, in a band like, say, 20 meters, I certainly believe you, Mel. An antenna looking at the horizon the average day on 80 meters probably sees something like a 50 decibel noise figure, just from the Mother Nature's noisy ionosphere with all those thunderstorms and everything else going on around the world. There's probably 500,000 thunderstorms going around the world at any one instant of time. They're all making noise. By the time you get down to 40 meters and 20 meters, you probably still have 25 or 30 decibels of noise figure. So therefore, a 20 decibel noise figure receiver is going to be 20 dB less sensitive, but the noise on the band is 30 dB above Mother Nature's what's called KTB. K is Boltzmann's constant, T is temperature in degrees Kelvin, B is bandwidth in hertz. You multiply those three factors together, once you know the temperature equivalent of what's coming in the antenna. If it was a 50 ohm resistor connected to the antenna port, and if it was at room temperature, which the IEEE defines as 290 degrees Kelvin, which is around 23 degrees centigrade, 22 degrees centigrade, and it's probably around 65 degrees Fahrenheit, then you know exactly how much noise is coming out of that resistor. Double the absolute temperature of the resistor, and you double the amount of noise. So, in other words, an amount of noise you get from your antenna has an equivalent noise temperature that in a good laboratory you could duplicate by heating up a resistor. Let me drop. In other words, if I've got a radio telescope that somebody tells me the front end receiver has, I'm going to pick numbers out of the air now, maybe it's a 5 decibel noise figure. And if I looked up the right equation, I'd find out that maybe a 5 decibel noise figure means that the excess noise made by the first amplification stage of that receiver is the same amount of noise as I would get from a 50 ohm resistor heated to 1,000 degrees Kelvin, which means it would glow in the dark. It would be a dull red glow. So you get a wire wound resistor heated up to 1,000 degrees Kelvin. It's made out of steel and it's glowing. The amount of noise coming out of it would be equal to the amount of noise generated by the first stage of my imperfect receiver. I could therefore say my receiver has an equivalent noise temperature of 1,000 degrees Kelvin. So every amount of noise can be represented either in the usual way of measuring it, how much deflection you get on a spectrum analyzer, dBm, decibels with reference to a milliwatt, per bandwidth, per megacycle, to say dBm per megacycle. And well, I can also measure it in degrees Kelvin equivalent. So you'll notice that the really good low noise preamplifiers that you buy for your satellite receiver system are rated in degrees Kelvin. A real good one would be 19 degrees Kelvin. The amount of noise that this less than perfect but damn good low noise amplifier that you use on your KU-band satellite direct broadcast receiver system might be 19 degrees Kelvin. Back in the days when we were using S-band satellites, they had such numbers. And so a 19 degree Kelvin, which is a cryogenically cooled resistor, it's a resistor that's 200 and some odd degrees below zero centigrade, equivalent, very quiet receiver. So noise power and degrees Kelvin have a one-to-one relationship. And that may help a little bit. So the environment on 20 meters is probably thousands of degrees Kelvin. You can have a pretty yucky receiver by bypassing the first RF amplifier. Although you don't get as much S-meter deflection, still the noise you're listening to coming down your antenna is above threshold of the receiver. That's all you really need to do. You connect the antenna to your receiver.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
If when you connect your antenna port to your receiver on HS and you hear on a quiet band when nobody is transmitting, you hear the noise of the band come up, probably on the S meter, but most likely coming out of the loudspeaker. If the noise increases when you connect your antenna, then the noise coming through your antenna is louder than the electronic noise made by your receiver most of the time in that particular test. In which case, you can make your receiver more sensitive if you wanted to. You probably are not going to see much improvement when you pass that test. Now, the reason why I say most of the time is to really be accurate. You should first put a 50-ohm termination on the receiver, then connect your antenna. The reason for that is some receivers are very happy looking into a 50-ohm antenna. If they look into an open circuit, they behave in a different manner and maybe generate a different amount of noise. It's a mismatched first stage of amplification. So you've got to be a little bit careful. 90-some-odd percent of the time, you do the connection and disconnection of the coax cable on the back of the receiver, and if you see the noise come up in the loudspeaker or in the S-meter, 90-some-odd percent of the time, you've arrived. You've got a receiver that's sensitive enough. You could put an extra preamplifier in there if you wanted to. It would just make the noise, if you added 10 more dB of gain, the noise coming in the antenna would be 10 dB louder out of the loudspeaker, or 10 dB louder on the S-meter. But if you were hearing it before you added the preamp, most of the time you're not going to make any further improvement. There's a slight variation to that, but that's getting into the nitty-gritty. I won't go there now. So you're probably going to do some further experiments, Jim, with match filtering, bandpass filtering, antenna aiming, using the attenuator on the front panel, and whatever. I think the guys listening would like to know in future weeks, if you'd come back, let us know what you've discovered. Because when you solve the problem of being able to hear the weakest possible signal on 146.52 without being overloaded by those particular unfortunate frequency spacings of those two repeaters, once you solve the problem, so to speak, and it's not going to go away immediately, you've got a reasonably tough problem here. It's going to require some technology, but as you develop ways of doing that, and you get better and better at DX on Monday and Tuesday night, I think we'd like to hear about it. So I hope you can come back and tell us what you discover.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
N2, November, Quebec, Kilo. K2LIW, you got it, Jim.
Okay, Dick, thank you very much. I appreciate everybody's help and comments. One last comment. I was, now that you're talking about bandpass cavities and things, I actually have, I have a bandpass cavity. And I honestly thought that I had used it, but now I'm not really sure. I have a Waco bandpass cavity here, and I will try it. Since Monday and Tuesday are usually my worst days listening on 5-2, I'm going to put the Waco cavity in the line and see if it actually helps the problem. I'd be very interested. I didn't even think of it at the time. I was just walking around, and I saw it sitting in the corner. But like I said, originally I thought I had that in the line, and it didn't make a difference. But I'm going to try it again and see if it works tomorrow. Back to you, Dick.
Hey, you wanted another comment?
No, recognized, but I'm going to put in a comment first here. When it comes to cavity filters, for a band as low as 2 meters, or 6 meters, but 2 meters in particular, there are filters and there are filters, Jim. And what is the unloaded Q of the filter is a very big variable here. If I made a very large, very high Q 2-meter filter by using a carefully designed galvanized garbage can as the and with the cover as the outer portion of the filter, put a reentrant rod inside and tuned it to 2 meters, and put two loading coils in there, and that exact filter that I just described is on the front cover of QST magazine. I think it's the May issue, 1972. I know because I have an article in that issue. But on the front cover of the May issue, 1972, is a guy who took a galvanized garbage can and made an extremely high Q cavity filter. Usually the higher the Q of the filter requires more volume of low conduct low resistivity materials. As the Q of the filter gets higher and higher, that means the internal loss of the filter gets lower and lower. The filter becomes sharper and sharper. And you can now tune a filter in such a way that it passes 146.52, but rejects 146.85 by 30 decibels. And I'm not kidding. Real high Q filter can do that. By comparison, if I had a tunable filter that I can tune, let's say, from 100 to 250 megacycles, and it's a reasonably low Q filter, the filter, because of its lower Q, might have an instantaneous bandwidth of half a megacycle. So that when I tune it to 146.52, it passes everything, or maybe it's got a megacycle of bandwidth, it passes everything from half a megacycle up to half a megacycle down within the 3 dB bandwidth. In which case, it'll make only a small improvement of your problem. It'll pass 146.52 very nicely, but its degree of rejection of 685 and 85 might only be a small number of dB, might only be a fraction of a dB. In which case, you might still get some benefit by tuning the filter off to one side, because the two offending signals, let me drop, are higher in frequency than your 146.52. If you tune your filter, because it's a little bit on the broadband side, to 146.4, while listening to 146.52, the 5.2 will come through with 1 dB of loss, but the 685 will come through with 10 dB of loss, Yeah, 146.685 will come through with 10 dB of loss, and 146.85 will come through with 20 dB of loss. If you tune the filter off to one side, you may see further improvement, an acceptable amount of attenuation on your signal, but a lot more attenuation of those other two offending signals. So even if you've got a low Q filter with a little too much bandwidth for your purpose, you can still get some benefit out of it if you tune it off to one side. Another set of experiments. But ultimately, you're going to want to build yourself, because it's not very expensive in materials, with copper tubing 3-inch diameter, 4-inch diameter, and another rod inside of it out of copper tubing. You don't have to go as big as a garbage can. You can make yourself an extremely high Q filter, as if you were building a duplexing filter for a repeater station. Build at least one or two stages of this. As I said, not very expensive materials. You can get out of Home Depot. And there's some nice articles in QST Magazine, among other places, telling you how to do this. Once you fabricate a really high Q filter and install it in your system, and maybe you're going to install it in between a preamplifier and the front end of the receiver, where now you can have your cake and eat it too. Low noise figure from the preamplifier, but it doesn't have so much gain that it overloads, but then pre-filtering, and so now you're going to get weak signal reception all the way down to 0.2 of a microvolt on the 146.52 signal DX you want to listen to, and still have tremendous number of decibels of rejection of the two offending signals, and now that's going to be the ideal system. That's one of the ways I would approach it. I didn't say it's easy, but it's not expensive, and it's a fun set of experiments. Fletcher Mills done things like that. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Well, I was going to make a comment on receiver technology. What has happened in the last couple of years, particularly so-called, you know, improved receiver performance. And I looked into it pretty much in depth. I wanted to see what the heck that I'm doing with the high-end, you know, piece of equipment that they're selling for enough to buy it. Basically, to buy a compact car for what some of these pieces of equipment is going for. You've seen one receiver that came out, in fact, that's just a receiver that's around $13K. And so I got a hold of basically, I just wanted to see what in the heck have they done to make these phenomenal improvements. And that, well, at first, you know, they're questionable, but then it's been confirmed by laboratory standards, you know, traced them through to the Bureau. And quite interesting what they've done, Dick, over.
Yep, doesn't surprise me, Mel. If you're smart enough when you design a receiver and you put enough high-level amplification, high-level meaning high-power amplification, if I literally took power-transmitting transistors and carefully choose the ones that just happen to have low noise figure, and make a receiver out of them, I've got them biased up to a high enough point where the Dawn stage is willing to start transmitting. They can produce 100 milliwatts of output.